Thank you, and be seated. Well, good morning. Nice to see everyone here with your bright, smiling faces as we begin 2009. We're going to call the case of State of Wisconsin ex rel Ira Robbins versus the Honorable Patrick J. Madden. But before I have the attorneys make argument and state the appearances, I want to recognize the students that are here today for this oral argument. And I think we have students from Xavier High School, is that correct? If you're here, would you please stand? Xavier High School? Thank you, and be seated. I always like the name Xavier. That's my brother's middle name, FX. And we have Madison West High School. Students from Madison West High School, you here? If you'd please stand and be recognized by the court. Thank you, and be seated. I'm now going to introduce the court to you. I'm going to start in the middle. You may note that we have an empty chair. Normally, Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson sits here, but she will not be participating in this case. I'm Ann Walsh Bradley. To my right, I'm going to introduce the esteemed Justice Prosser, and to his right is Justice Ziegler. All of us, by the way, are esteemed. That's why I don't at least for today, at least for right now. To my left, then, is Justice Brooks. Next to him is Justice Rogensack, and on the far end is Justice Gableman. By way, then, of those introductions, we will now proceed with the case. And Mr. Owens, you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, as I try not to trip over my chair. We are here today on, I would have to say, appears to be almost a teaching function for the bar and for the bench in the John Doe conducting of proceedings, which is something that is not a frequent occurrence. The John Doe proceeding in Wisconsin, as the court knows from its more recent case involving Judge Murray, goes back to before Wisconsin was a state, in the 1830s. And it has been embodied in our Constitution and now in a statute that was, I believe, most recently amended in 1994. I compliment the Attorney General's brief on some of the historical references in there. I think the reference in the legislative history is helpful to the court in addressing some of the issues. The John Doe proceeding is very similar to a grand jury proceeding, which is typically used in the federal courthouse. And I know Justice Ziegler had worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office before her elevation to the benches. And the federal grand jury gives us some reference points that perhaps are helpful to the court. One of them I learned was that the power of the disinterested magistrate sitting in John Doe Court is not really an Article III judge under the federal rules and under the Constitution of the United States. And in our state, we've never quite addressed the specific jurisdictional basis of the exercise of the power of the state of Wisconsin by a judge sitting in a John Doe proceeding. We know that the rules of evidence specifically tell us that they do not apply in John Doe and grand jury proceedings. And that's something that it's 911.01 sub 4. So when a circuit court judge who may never have had a John Doe proceeding before him or her is presented with one, I think they look, first of all, to the Wisconsin Judicial Bench Book, which has only got 4 pages in it on it, I think. And the Wisconsin Jury Instruction Service has a discussion of that. But there is precious little guidance, I think. I don't go to judicial conferences other than to provide entertainment in a certain rock and roll band. but that is judges and lawyers and appellate judges for fun. But I don't go to your continuing judicial education conferences, but I have asked some of the judges that I know personally on the circuit court bench whether there's any training on something such as a John Doe, and I've been told not really. Maybe it's just they've missed it, but it might be something that the Supreme Court could, as an adjunct to all this, conduct and assign some people to create a special program on.
Counselor, I were to assume that because the judge began the hearing with the examination of Mr. Robbins, that he had concluded that Mr. Robbins had an objectively reasonable belief that a crime had been committed, and his review of the petition showed him that in some parts he might agree with that being an objectively reasonable view, and in some parts of the petition he might not agree, because the petition alleges a lot of different crimes, okay? So let's just assume that the judge agreed with some parts of the petition, but not all, so the statute then had him go forward. Could the judge pick and choose which witnesses he was obligated to investigate or to hear from personally under your theory, or would he have to hear everyone under your theory that the plaintiff had provided once he went forward? Does that make, do you know what I'm trying to get to?
I totally understand.
And okay, thanks.
To demonstrate, this screenwriter indicates what actually the trial judge was presented with, and in each tab were the background documents supporting the skeletal numbered paragraphs as to each individual, and there were a number of individuals who had complaints to make about this particular district attorney. I would answer your question. I would think that the judge would have to examine each one of the allegations by person and in the ring binder and its exhibits, then determine whether that person was a witness for any one of those particular allegations. If the witness had no connection, I would think that he would inquire, or she, in this case, he would inquire what connection this witness that you propose has to the petition. Once the witness's connection to the petition either is obvious, because it might be the person who's the subject of the allegation, or a witness to it, I believe the court is required, under the statute, the plain reading of the statute, to hear and, quote, examine the witness.
I didn't make myself clear. The witnesses that were identified, each witness did not relate to every part of the petition. Assume that when the judge looked at the petition, he found some parts showed that Mr. Robbins had an objectively reasonable basis to believe a crime had committed, but some parts did not show that. If a witness was related to a part of the petition which the court believed Mr. Robbins could not have had an objectively reasonable basis for believing a crime had been committed, would he have to interview that witness simply because Mr. Robbins produced it?
I understand the question more.
Yeah, it's a hard, convoluted question, but it's bugging me, obviously.
I believe that the judge would have to be very careful and analyze the allegation of the petitions that he found not to have merit, and have to know whether that witness had anything to say about that allegation that had no merit, because if it has no merit, it stops. Mm-hmm. So I guess there has to be a winnowing and sifting. First of all, these allegations I find to have merit, and these I don't. Judge Madden,
you have to say that if he was going to use that as a
judge. I would think one would have to do that and separate out, and then there would have to be, I think, almost a voir dire, unless it was obvious that the person had nothing to do with the ones that the judge had said had merit, at least some kind of a voir dire of the witness to determine no connection. And this is complicated because If the rules of evidence do not apply, then even as in my brief, I suggested relevance would be a touchstone. I'm not sure that the circuit court judge is going to use relevancy. He'll have to come to some conclusion that the witness has nothing to say that would support this objective test of reasonable belief that a crime occurred.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Owens,
yes,
in your brief at page 4, you say there were several hours of summarized testimony by the complainant, and that the judge then stated he'd take all the summarized testimony, all the factual allegations as true, but would not then take witnesses' testimony from the people that were produced there. And based on that, then, he made the record regarding probable cause, but then it translated to an order that didn't reflect probable cause. Tell me what you find fault with in that procedure.
The statute is absolutely clear that once the threshold determination is made that the complainant has a reasonable basis to believe that a crime has been committed, that the court, acting as a magistrate, not as a circuit court judge, must examine, shall examine the complainant, and the word is examine the complainant, and the witnesses called by the complainant. It goes on, the statute says, based upon the testimony, you make your then determination about probable cause. You can't have testimony if you don't have witnesses.
I hear what you're saying. It does say shall. But then at the bottom of that section of the statute, it says it's within the judge's discretion, the extent to which the judge will proceed with examination. So are you saying the judge should have said, okay, I'll let you take the stand, state your name, I don't have any questions for you, go ahead and step down?
That may be what a particular judge might do in that circumstance. I think that would be improper. When a citizenry in that number have come forth and alleged criminal conduct or potentially criminal conduct, and they want to be heard, and their only access when a district attorney, in this case, a district attorney is alleged to have done all of these wrongful conduct. There is no other engine available to address it. A district attorney has absolute civil immunity for any wrongdoing, so there can be no civil action brought.
What you're saying. So, but, you know, when we decide a case, it's not confined to a case that just deals with district attorneys. So from this point forward, it seems that the rule that you're asking this court to adopt would be, so long as people voluntarily will come to court, the judge must hear them and ask them questions on the stand for some period of time.
I believe the statute requires that.
So, in a prisoner litigation case where someone wants to voluntarily produce everyone from the cell block because they may have heard something, the judge then will need to produce all of those individuals and then hear from all of those individuals?
Well, that would be the most extreme situation of an abuse of the John Doe procedure.
But under your rule, I'm trying to figure out where the judge's discretion begins and ends so that we can have a reasonable rule here for people to know what they can and cannot do.
I agree. And there has to be a point at which the balancing tests come into play under due process. Where that line is to be drawn, I think, has to be done on a case-by-case basis and an abuse of discretion. Although this person is not sitting as a circuit court judge, I don't believe, actually. And that is something I think needs to be addressed by this court, to define for the circuit court judge sitting in that magistrate investigatory body, is he like the district attorney or the U.S. attorney in a grand jury? But not really, because the statute also says that the duties of the district attorney are to participate in all John Doe proceedings. So what is the role? Is this judge sitting judicially? That is a tougher question, because what would be the review basis? We have said in other decisions, or you have said in other decisions, bring a writ of supervision or a supervisory writ to review the conduct of a judge sitting as a John Doe magistrate. And that's what was done here, and that was done in Judge Murray's case and in other cases, typically as a supervisory writ. I assume that is a supervisory writ as a judge who is sitting in this magistrate role, to make the decision not to hear the testimony of the witnesses produced and available, justice, would be a violation of the statutory directive by someone who doesn't have the power to make that choice.
Let's assume that on the first day 100 people show up and the judge can only get through 50, so it has to be adjourned. On the second day, the same 50 that weren't examined on the first day show up plus another 50. The judge then has to keep going until all the witnesses are exhausted?
If it's cumulative, I'm sure at some point the rules of reason and balancing would take over, justice. But I don't think we can use the extreme to say, therefore, there's unfettered discretion to say, I'm not going to listen to these witnesses because it's not efficient use of my time. I'll just take it all as true, and I just don't think it merits a probable cause. Because that's not what the statute says. The statute says those people get a chance to be heard. And something may be said by those witnesses that is not said by the summary witness, Mr. Robbins, who is here today. And those, I think, do qualify as offers of proof to respond to one of the issues raised by the state in its brief, that there was no offer of proof. If nothing else, that's what Mr. Robbins' testimony turned into as he went through each of the paragraph allegations of this various claims that he had discovered, and as he went through them point by point, if they aren't testifying and the rules of evidence don't apply, I guess that's an offer of proof. But the statute, nevertheless, requires the judge to hear the witnesses, and there were not 50 or 100, and there were only 8 or 9. The prisoners could testify by video, as they do in your cell block issue, as they do in other cases, or teleconferencing, if that were to be required in a given case. And if this is overly burdensome on the judiciary, then the legislature is going to have to address that, and the Attorney General's office has lobbied for that. But, as we are warned in the other languages of the writs of supervision, and when there's a clear mandate in the statute, we cannot have judicial legislation, and that is a theme that touches all areas of the law, and not just criminal law. So here we are with a clear and unambiguous statute, and a judge not following it on the facts of this case. And so the writ should issue, and the case should be reopened, and the witnesses should be heard. And maybe it's an exercise in futility, because Judge Madden may say, none of this matters to me. It's all, take it all as true. There are other avenues open. OLR, civil, he was wrong about civil. OLR, in this instance, has no specifically trained section for misconduct by district attorneys and prosecutors. And they have civil immunity. There is no one else to investigate. The Attorney General's office has a conflict of interest, because if they are defending a person that they find as wrongdoing, they expose their client, the state of Wisconsin, to possible civil liability under Section 1983. So the Attorney General's office, if, as we saw with Joe Paulus, the district attorney from Winnebago County, it took forever to actually catch that man in all the wrongful conduct he was doing, because he was politically connected, and all these immunities, and OLR was not equipped to handle it. So, actually, the John Doe is the only engine available in some instances, and this was one. And Judge Madden did not perceive that. He needed to hear those witnesses, and they needed to be heard. Otherwise, it's perceived as a whitewash by the
Charles, you've been asked this in a different way, I think, by a couple of my colleagues. But let me ask you more directly. The statute 968.26 says the extent to which the judge may proceed in the examination is within the judge's discretion. What does that mean? If it doesn't mean exactly what those words say, that the judge has discretion to decide what he's going to hear or she is going to hear in making the determination in terms of reason to believe and probable cause.
It means, as I think Justice Ziegler's question was, that you can control the scope, but you are required to let the citizens be heard.
Where does it say that?
The first sentence says you must examine the witnesses called, and that the scope of the examination, the extent, and the word is examination, the failure to call or not to call. It says examination, and examination, when we use in the courtrooms, are direct examination, cross-examination. That is an interactive process.
You know, it's unusual for the legislature, at least in my experience, to put in language in a statute that talks about conducting the examination within the judge's discretion. Why do you think it was put here? What's the legislative history that you're aware of in regard to that language?
The legislative history I'm aware of is the same that the Attorney General brought to the court's attention here. I can only read the statute and see that they did not change the word examination. They did certainly move to make precatory the duty to charge or not to charge on prosecutive choice issues, and they tried to put standards in which were then taken out, but the broad discretion was given not at the stage of investigation, it was given at the stage of accusation and process into the civil or the criminal system. And I think the judges are reacting to not having to take the time to conduct the examination. They're given discretion to limit the examination, but they can't just, as Judge Fiedler did in the Ryman case, say, well, I'll just read the police reports and I understand. And this Court of Appeals and perhaps even the Supreme Court at the time said, well, we agree with you. It might be a waste of time, but the way the statute's written, you do have to do this. And we need to go back to the reasons for the statute, which are that the citizenry need a forum that is not otherwise available them to be heard. It may be inconvenient for the court, but they need to be heard. And to take that away when it goes back to 1839, because it's inconvenient for the circuit bench, I think would be overstepping the bounds of this court, with all due respect.
Counsel, we... Are we finished, Justice?
Yes.
We issued a order when we accepted this case, adding a couple of questions. One of the questions added was whether a John Doe judge is required to subpoena every witness that a John Doe petitioner requests, or whether the John Doe judge has discretion to decide which subpoenas should be issued. What's your position on that question?
My position, as stated in my brief, was that I believe the statute is clear and the court has complete discretion, the way the statute reads, to issue or non-issue subpoenas, and that power is exclusively with the circuit court bench.
And that's
judge.
That is distinct from your position with regard to whether or not a judge has discretion to examine witnesses called by the plaintiff.
Absolutely different, and I agree with the state's position and the court's ruling, at least implicit ruling in Murray, that this is exclusively the court's province, the John Doe court's, the issuance of the subpoenas, and that is discretionary and can't be forced. It's not mandatory to do so and is fully discretionary. The statute on listening to the witnesses produced by the complainant is different. And I might add, unless I forget this, the statute, as an attorney appearing for the first time before a John Doe proceeding, as I was in this instance, having to learn this all from scratch, I was immediately told by the judge, following the judicial bench book standard, that I could not speak, I could not ask questions, I couldn't examine witnesses, and I couldn't argue to the court. If one reads the statute, it says that the witnesses' attorneys can't do those things. It draws a distinction, possibly, between a complainant and the witness. And if that's true, what happened in this instance, because the district attorney could not, due to a conflict of interest, obviously, sit there with the judge as his statutory duties are, I mentioned in the brief, the district attorney is supposed to participate in John Doe's. He could not. There really was no one to assist Judge Mann. And there should have been a special prosecutor appointed. I think the statutes are very clear that when there's a conflict of interest, the district attorney, it says he shall ask for an appointment. In this case, the district attorney did not ask. So there was none. And yet I, as the complainant's attorney, wasn't allowed to virtually speak. So that was a deprivation of a procedural, certainly a procedural methodology contemplated by the John Doe statute, that someone would perform a function of counsel assisting the John Doe judge, which did not happen here, which put more pressure on the John Doe judge, and therefore perhaps more of an inclination to say, I don't have time for this, there's no helping here with winnowing and sifting, I don't have a special prosecutor to address these claims, and even Mr. Owens wasn't allowed to do so myself. I believe that that needs to be clarified, that the complainant's attorney may or may not participate. That is an open question under the statute. And I was not allowed to. I think that was incorrect, and I ask for the opportunity to do that next time. I think the John Doe court needs to hear the testimony of the witnesses that are certainly present and co-authored, even if it's constricted, one sentence or two sentences, but the credibility and the story that they have to tell needs to be heard from the citizen's perspective rather than the bench's perspective. We have to always remember that that's what this statute was about. The citizenry's right to have a forum when there is no other forum, or it's not available to them. Most often would occur in a situation where someone in authority, such as either a warden or a district attorney, would be accused of something wrong, or guards, someone in positions of authority that there is no other way to review, and the district attorney in particular, is a person that there needs to be oversight, there need to be a special prosecutor, and that needed to have been appointed. And on remand, I'm asking this court to direct that a special prosecutor be appointed. The Attorney General's office certainly can't investigate this district attorney under these circumstances. They are representing the court saying we don't need to. They have a conflict of interest. There needs to be a special prosecutor, and I refer the court to the statutes on that. Are there any other questions? Because I don't want to belabor this. I would defer to the state.
Seeing none, and your light is on.
Okay, and the red light just came on, so I was timing right.
Omniscient. Good timing. Counsel.
May it please the court, I'm David Rice. I'm an assistant attorney general. In this particular case, I appear on behalf of the Honorable Patrick Madden. But in effect, I appear today before you on behalf of all circuit judges in the state of Wisconsin who require clarification on the issues presented in this case. The way I see your opinion in this case is an opportunity to prepare a primer for judges who administer the John Doe statute at the circuit court level so that the statute is clear and that their responsibilities under the statute become clear. Let me just take care of one quick point about the role of a district attorney in John Doe proceedings. When I was preparing for the argument today, I ran across a John Doe decision which really addressed this point precisely, and I didn't cite it in my brief, so I wanted to bring it to your attention. State versus unnamed defendant, 150, Wisconsin 2nd, 352. At page 360, this court says, the John Doe is normally and preferably carried out in cooperation with the district attorney. As desirable as such cooperation may be, however, the John Doe statute itself requires no participation by the district attorney. So I think this argument that somehow, because enumerating the duties of the district attorneys in the statute, one of those enumerated duties is to participate in John Doe proceedings, that doesn't mean that the John Doe, that the district attorney must participate in every John Doe proceeding.
Should Mr. Owens have been permitted to participate?
I don't believe so. I don't think this is an adversary proceeding. I don't think that counsel has a right to be heard in that situation. I think the judge conducts and examines the witnesses as you've described, being a neutral magistrate, and then reaches certain decisions in the case. I don't think it's appropriate, and I believe that's always been the practice. I think Mr. Owens describes it correctly. They're entitled to be present if they're an attorney for a witness, but not to participate in the John Doe. I think he's also right. The statute doesn't speak to the role of an attorney for the complainant. but I don't believe that that would be appropriate. The purpose of the, in the Riemann case, this court said that one of the purposes of the John Doe proceeding is to provide crime victims and other complainants recourse to the judicial branch when the executive branch fails to respond to their complaints. That's how these cases often arise. Somebody goes to the district attorney. District attorney says, I don't find any merit, I'm not going to proceed. So then the person goes to court, either in a John Doe under 968-26 or under the alternative, I think it's 968-03 sub 2 or 02 sub 3. But basically you go to the court to try to get the court to issue a criminal complaint because the district attorney refuses to do that. So I want to start with what happens when you go to court and you present your petition to the John Doe judge. If you look at the cases, there's often a lot of confusion. If you look at State Ex Rel Williams versus Fiedler, Judge Fiedler's a good judge, and the court recognized that he was applying his common sense in that case. But in making the first of the three decisions that a John Doe judge must make, that is, whether the petition objectively states grounds from which the judge an objective, reasonable person could believe that a crime had been committed, you're only permitted to look at the petition itself. What Judge Fiedler did was to consider information from the district attorney's office and various police reports and saying, when I look at all of this, I don't believe that this case could successfully be prosecuted. I don't think it's a provable offense. So we had just Judge Fiedler commingling two or three different concepts that shouldn't be commingled in these John Doe cases. And I think it's important when you write your decision that you clarify these separate stages. So the first stage is this threshold, and you called it threshold in the Riemann case, determination of whether the petition is adequate to get to the John Doe hearing. And the standards are set forth in Riemann. I won't belabor them. But that's the first decision that the John Doe must make. And at least as the statute is presently worded, and as you've interpreted it, that determination has to be made simply on the face of the petition itself. Now, in a footnote in this case, my footnote 3, I suggest that maybe the law ought to be changed. And maybe the statute can say that the judge shall proceed, or that the judge may proceed with a John Doe hearing, considering not only the petition, but other information, like police reports and information from the district attorney's office. There was a bill introduced in the last session of the legislature. It was introduced very late in February of 2008. 2007 Senate Bill 537, which would have done just that. It would have changed the shall to may and would have expressly permitted the John Doe judge in determining whether to proceed with the hearing to consider information outside of the John Doe petition itself in determining whether the complainant actually had reason to believe that a crime had been committed. But anyway, that's step one, and it's a very distinct step, and it gets confused. Judge Fiedler confused it with the question of prosecutive merit or provable offense. Judge Madden did not confuse those terms. As I'll get to in a minute, there may be some confusion between his determination on probable cause, which is the second decision, and prosecutive merit, which is the third decision. But we start with this threshold question. In this case, Judge Madden never expressly made that determination, but implicitly decided that Mr. Owen's client satisfied that threshold burden. So for step one, Judge Madden ruled in favor of Mr. Robbins and the persons that he represented. Then we get to step two. The second decision for a John Doe judge is whether there's probable cause to believe that a crime was committed based not on the petition, but based on the testimony that was given before the judge. In this case, there was testimony given before the judge. There was more than 2 hours of testimony given before the judge. And based on that testimony, the judge decided that there was not probable cause because there was insufficient evidence to sustain each of the elements that would be necessary to establish that a crime had been committed. Now, unfortunately, in his decision, he does it somewhat inartfully. He begins, if you look at his oral ruling, he says, I'm bound by Riemann and I have to look at probable cause, and I don't think the evidence meets probable cause. But then later he talks about, doesn't use the word prosecutor merit, but whether it's provable, and his written order also belies that adherence to the appropriate standard. But I think if you read the entirety of his oral ruling, it's pretty clear he understood that his job was to make this second decision, which is the probable cause decision, that he evaluated the evidence, and he determined that that evidence, as a matter of law, did not give rise to misconduct. He said some people may disagree with the exercise of prosecutorial discretion. In the case of the employment decisions he made, they may disagree with his employment decisions as a district attorney, but that none of those decisions individually or aggregated amounted to a crime. Then we get to the third decision, and it's important that, I think it's very important that your opinion address this as a separate decision, and I'll tell you why. A while ago, within the last couple of years, inmates have brought complaints against correctional officers for incidents often involving cell extractions. And there may even be a videotape of what occurred, but the judge can't look at that, but can only consider the petition itself in originally making the decision, which will go forward with the John Doe. Then when you conduct the John Doe, you hear the inmate convey his side of the story, and you're bound to accept that at the probable cause stage. You can't consider the countervailing testimony and weigh the conflicting evidence. So some judges found probable cause based on the inmate testimony and issued a criminal complaint against the correctional officer. And so the correctional officer not only had to defend himself in the John Doe proceeding and have representation, but also had to represent himself in the criminal complaint, against the criminal complaint that was issued. And that's really what gave rise to this spate of legislation. It wasn't because the director of state courts and our office were able to convince legislators to act. It was because the union or unions went to the legislature and said, we don't want our correctional officers subject to these frivolous criminal complaints based solely upon the inmate's testimony, which can't be contested in a probable cause hearing. Well, in part, the judges were making those decisions and signing those complaints because they didn't read the statute carefully enough. They thought that if probable cause was found, if they decided there was probable cause, they were compelled to reduce the criminal complaint to writing and have a warrant issued for the arrest of, in those cases, the correctional officer. But the statute doesn't read that way, and it was changed. And it was changed even before this court's decision in Riemann, although Riemann didn't address that question. The statute used to say, upon a finding of probable cause, the criminal complaint shall be reduced to writing and a warrant issued. In 1991, they changed that. They took out the word shall and they put in the word may. And regardless of the legislative history of that provision, it means something to go from shall to may. Now what I suggest to you is that it means that the judge has discretion, even if they found probable cause, to decide whether or not to have a criminal complaint issued and a warrant issued for the arrest of the accused. Now that legislative history of that provision I've included in my brief, and it was an effort, it clearly was an effort to define what the judge was supposed to consider in deciding that third question, whether to issue the complaint, and the bill read in terms of prosecutive merit and gave specific directions in terms of the criteria to be applied. That language was not enacted. They simply changed the word shall to may, so we don't know exactly what the legislative body had in mind. But I would suggest to you that they probably did that in order not to limit the circuit judges to a particular group of criteria, but to leave it within their discretion. So, in any event, there's three decisions to be made here. The probable cause decision, the reason to believe decision, the probable cause decision, and the prosecutor, what I call the prosecutor merit decision. All three are independent decisions, and their significance in this case primarily is whether or not Judge Madden improperly commingled the second and third decisions.
Counselor, can you talk about prosecutorial discretion, which is kind of a troublesome term for me.
I understand that.
Even if the judge decides that a criminal complaint should be issued, and that complaint then is sent to the district attorney, can't the district attorney himself still decide whether or not he will proceed on that complaint?
You would think so. What happened in Grant County on one of these corrections officers' cases is the judge issued the complaint based on the belief that he had to. The district attorney refused to prosecute. The judge ordered or secured the district attorney from the adjoining county to prosecute as a special prosecutor because the district attorney wouldn't do it. And then the DA from the adjoining county told the judge he wouldn't do it either. And as far as I know, the case never was prosecuted beyond that. So there is a practical problem. I thought you were going to allude to, which I think is maybe hidden in here, which is a potential constitutional issue about mixing the judicial function with the
executive
function.
That's
which is a problem. I mean, that's a potential problem here, but it's not something that, you know, that we've discussed. I mean, I don't know how far down one direction a judge goes and is wearing a judicial hat, and then all of a sudden isn't that neutral anymore and becomes an executive branch prosecutor. But there is that element intermingled in that decision. I would suggest that those are three separate statutory decisions. If there's the constitutional infirmity to the third one, possibly, then that's something that will have to be litigated at some point.
I think as long as the district attorney has a separate and independent executive function, which from what you've just told me, it appears at least some district attorneys are executing, we won't know the answer to whether there's a problem or not until some kind of a case like that comes up and it's well briefed.
Correct. I'm just trying to establish what I think is the basic statutory framework in terms of explaining why I think Judge Madden reached the correct result here, but also to try to provide some clarity for those judges out there who issue a criminal complaint immediately upon a finding of probable cause in the belief that that's what's required. And I think they need to be educated that the statute doesn't read that way.
Let me ask you the question that I asked opposing counsel, and I know it's a circuitous question, but maybe because I've tried twice, it'll work easier this time. If the judge determines, as he must have here, that Mr. Robbins had an objectively reasonable basis for believing a crime had been committed, as shown by the face of the petition, but he doesn't think that every crime alleged in the petition meets that criteria, and some of the witnesses relate to parts of the petition where the judge concludes there couldn't be an objectively reasonable basis to assert a crime had been committed. Would the judge, in your view, have to interview any of those people that would relate to those parts of the petition?
Well, I think the answer is clearly not. The cases don't, I don't know of a case in which a petition was found to be reasonable only in part and not in another part. But assuming the hypothetical, there'd be no reason to hear any evidence relating to allegations that don't meet the threshold standard. So the judge, I think, clearly can refuse to hear that testimony.
Okay, so then to take the next step, just say that there is a part of a petition or a petition that claims a crime has been committed, and on its face it satisfies the first standard. And there is a witness produced in addition to the complainant. Does the judge have to interview that witness?
I think the answer to that is no. And the reason that I think the answer is no is because the statute, it admittedly is not well drafted and has some internal conflicts, which the Court of Appeals recognized in this case. And it's, I can't get around this language. And in the HIP case, you and I, Justice Bradley and I, had a colloquy about that. But the statute says that the judge shall examine the complainant and his or her witnesses. I can't get around that. But the statute also says, as Justice Crooks points out, that the judge has discretion as to the extent of the examination. And so one way to construe it would be what Justice Ziegler said was, you call the witness, you have to call every witness, you have to ask them their name, and then you can stop because you can control the extent of the examination. But I think that the court is going to construe or should construe the statute to avoid absurd results. And if the judge determines that the testimony that would be offered by a particular witness is cumulative or not relevant, and I like the idea of a voir dire because that's exactly what the Court of Appeals suggested in Sames. The inmate, or the, not all inmates, the John Doe complainant says, I'd like to call these witnesses, Judge, and I'd like to have you subpoena these witnesses. And the judge says, okay, well, tell me what, generally, what they're going to say and how that's pertinent to this proceeding. And then the judge decides either to subpoena the witnesses or not, or to hear the witnesses or not. And that decision, then, is subject to review by the Court of Appeals. I don't want to appear here saying that somehow the judges are not sympathetic with hearing John Doe complainants or having them be able to present their case. And judges should be forced to make these decisions and to have some rationale for why they're allowing the evidence or disallowing the evidence or granting a subpoena or not granting a subpoena. But then that rationale can be reviewed if they've made an error. So that the John Doe complainant, you said in Riemann that the statute wasn't designed to give them their day in court. I think that they should at least be heard and that their witness should be heard if it's reasonable. But whether there's an abuse of discretion by the circuit judge can be reviewed on appeal. So I don't know if I've answered your question directly. There are some inherent tensions within the statute, but I think it has to be construed in a way that makes sense.
Thank you.
Mr. Rice, let me ask you some questions having to do with prosecutive merit. I was thinking back to a case that I sat on a number of years ago, a John Doe proceeding that went on for several days, and quite candidly, when I got to the point of whether or not there was prosecutive merit, I certainly relied upon, in that particular case, the special prosecutor and the recommendation of the special prosecutor. And I'm wondering when the John Doe magistrate, if you will, or John Doe judge, as we're calling him today, makes a determination on prosecutive merit, whether or not there doesn't have to be some deference given to the recommendation made by either the district attorney or a special prosecutor in terms of this exercise of discretion which appears there. How do you see those things fitting together?
Well, I guess I'd answer it two ways. If you look at the Fiedler, Williams versus Fiedler case, the Court of Appeals agreed with Judge Fiedler that if you took all of the information that Judge Fiedler had before him and didn't limit yourself to the petition, that it would be unlikely that a jury would come back with a favorable response, and that you would be hard-pressed in light of all this conflicting and but weightier evidence in their mind to proceed. So I think the judge can consider that in making the decision. Should he defer to the DA? Well, you got to remember the DA was the one who refused to initiate proceedings in the first place, which is why we got to the John Doe. So I don't think you can give total deference to the district attorney, but I think whatever the district attorney says is certainly whatever persuasive weight that expression would have would be something the court ought to consider in deciding whether to issue the complaint.
Isn't it often true that the district attorney uses a John Doe proceeding in order to develop evidence, in order to get people on the record in terms of what they're going to testify to ultimately if there's a prosecution?
Yes.
So it's not just that a district attorney has declined to prosecute. It may very well be that the district attorney wants to develop the evidence before prosecuting.
It's clearly the case. And I think because I'm speaking to this case and HIP and some of the others we've talked about recently that develop in a different way, that I made the response that I did. Clearly, the John Doe performs an important function for district attorneys to be able to develop evidence to pursue possible criminal conduct. People in our office, people in the district attorney's office, it's very important. Your Washington decision speaks to that. I'm restricting myself to that smaller group of cases. where it's a citizen-initiated complaint following a refusal of the district attorney to initiate a complaint. Certainly the John Doe proceeding, though, and the district attorney's role in district attorney-initiated John Doe's is a very, very important role, and I didn't mean to denigrate it by my response.
Counsel, I get this feeling in my stomach that we are making some of this stuff up out of whole cloth, that there are, I would say, issues or problems or concerns, whatever delicate word you want to use, with the way the statute is written. And the question for me is, how much do we come in and patch it up and take care of it? The question asked by Justice Brooks ties in my mind, to the very first statement that you made in your argument today, citing the case from 150 with second, that essentially said, hey, DAs, as I heard it, I haven't read it because it wasn't cited, but hey, DAs, you know, you're not allowed to participate. That's what I heard you say, because Attorney Owen was chafing at the bit that he, so to speak, that he wanted to talk. He wanted to say something. And no, he couldn't. And so you're saying, well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Look at 150 with second. Yeah. And now how does that follow with what Justice Crooks is talking about, which makes all the sense in the world to me, that the DA should have some input and some argument on prosecutive merit, if you even find prosecutive merit in this statute. Of course, those words don't appear at all.
Right. There's nothing that describes the judge's discretion to make the third decision.
Yeah, that's right. We're making...
I make that shorthand prosecutive merit because of the legislative history, which I think, even though it wasn't enacted word for word, I think that's what they intended, but they shortened it so that it wasn't limited.
Okay.
That's how I read it. You don't have
that's
to
That's the
to
maybe shall to me.
But
yeah.
Let me distinguish the areas where I think you can go, and where I think the legislature will have to take care of the rest.
Well, I want you primarily to focus on this issue of who can talk. Can the DA talk? Can the the complainant's attorney talk? After all, 968.26, the statute that we're looking at, uses complainants, uses witnesses, uses the word district attorney, and on the prohibition of what counsel can't talk, it's witnesses' counsel. Doesn't say anything about complainants' counsel can't talk. Doesn't say anything about DA can't talk or can talk. And so what should we do about this?
Well, I agree with you. I don't think the statute addresses it. I think the district attorney has a role to play in the prosecution of crime and the development of criminal complaints. I think they ought to be an active participant. When a district attorney is not part of the proceeding, and the case I cited doesn't say, I think, that they shouldn't be. It says that they don't have to be.
They don't have to be, okay.
But when they're not, a witness can't have an attorney. And I think the reason is because the John Doe judge wants to be able to conduct these efficiently and to be able to have them proceed in an orderly way. So you don't want them participating.
No problem.
The statute doesn't address the complainant's thing, but I would think that the rationale would be the same.
Why? I mean, if the statute wanted to say that, they used the complainant, that word, several times in 968.26. They distinguish it from witness several times, but now you want us to take the language that says the witness can't have counsel and say, oh, they really meant to say and complainant can't have counsel.
No, I don't know that they can't have counsel present.
I mean,
I'm just saying, I don't know that the counsel can participate as an active participant in the John Doe and have a right to examine or cross-examine witnesses. I would think that the legislature would have provided for that. It's certainly not been true historically.
Let's look at the exact language rather than me paraphrasing it in 968.26, which states about midway through that statute, any witness examined under this section may have counsel present at the examination, but the counsel shall not be allowed to examine his or her client, cross-examine other witnesses, or argue before the judge. I think that's relatively clear. The question that arises is whether or not that applies to the complainant, even though it says a witness.
I don't believe that it expressly governs complainants. The statute does use different language. I'm just saying that that is a discretionary decision, I think, for the presiding judge as to whether he's going to allow that participation or not. I don't think a complainant has any right to have that kind of role, to examine or cross-examine witnesses.
I think or to argue to the court.
I think that's dependent on the judge. I think the judge is the fact finder, and he hears it. It's up to he or her hears the case.
I would say, fair enough. Let it up to the discretion of the court, because that makes sense to me. But when I look at the language of the statute, it says the counsel shall not be allowed to argue before the judge.
I don't think there's any express mention implied exclusion here that would augur in favor of allowing a complainant's attorney to have an active role in Gondo. I just don't think that's the way it works.
So this language in the statute regarding counsel for witness, in your mind, only applies to witnesses and not complainants?
Yes.
Okay. And so what we want to do for complainant's counsel is whatever the six of us decide complainant's counsel should be able to do. Or should we leave it to the legislature?
I think you should leave it to the presiding judge and presiding John Doe judge to decide how best it ought to be.
To me, that makes good sense. My question was a step back from that. In other words, since the statute is silent on the participation that a attorney for a complainant may have, that can we weigh in and say, oh, since it's silent, we'll say the judge has the discretion to decide. Now, that's not in the statute. The court may consider, none of that's in the statute. We're just kind of making that up.
But your earlier decisions, like Washington and other cases, have talked about the broad discretion of the judge to efficiently and fairly conduct the proceedings, and I think it's
important. Because that makes sense. It's just not in here.
Let me just react with one caveat to all of this. This was not an issue that was presented in the briefs. This is not an issue that I've researched. I don't know if there's any legislative history about whether complainants' attorneys may or may not examine witnesses, whether that was a concept ever presented or rejected by the legislature. I don't know the answer to some of the questions you're asking, and I apologize for that, but it wasn't something that...
Well, I don't know the answer either, so don't apologize.
Justice Foster?
Well, you may have answered this question before, and I apologize. If the complaint meets the threshold that you talk about, is the judge required to examine the complainant?
I think so. I don't see any way around that.
Okay. And that's right in the first sentence of the statute.
Exactly. Well, because the reason I say that is because the probable cause determination has to be based on evidence. It has to be based on the testimony given in the John Doe. You can't base it simply on the petition. So I think somebody would have to be examined. There'd have to be some evidence presented.
Well, in that sentence, if the judge is required to examine the complainant, why wouldn't the judge also be required to examine the witnesses?
Well, that's what the statute says. I appreciate that. And I think the reason is because the statute also says the judge has discretion as to the extent of examination. And you could read those sentences, like Justice Ziegler raised the hypothetical, to say you'd have to call every witness produced by the complainant, there could be hundreds, and ask them their name, and then I guess you could say, well, I'm determining the extent of the examination, I don't need to hear any more from you. But I think it makes more sense, and you don't want an absurd construction to say that you don't have to either subpoena or examine those people in the first instance.
But the discretion that you would invoke here does not apply with respect to the complainant. All right?
I suppose you could even have it as to the complainant, but my concern there is I think the statute at least envisions that the complainant have an opportunity to come into court and tell his or her side of the story as alleged in the petition, which the court has deemed sufficient to allow the person to come to court, and then to decide at least on that evidence, and more, if it's desirable. In HIP, for instance, it was desirable to have an additional six or seven witnesses come forward because they had pertinent, relevant evidence to offer.
If a person complains to a judge that he or she has reason to believe that a crime has been committed, the court has put a gloss on that. I mean, it's not just totally conclusory.
No, it has to be an objective and non-conclusory allegations, right?
So, was it wrong to put a gloss on that?
I don't believe so. I think courts read statutes reasonably, hopefully. And they, in this case, they read them in a way that makes sense both for the complainants and for the judges and the judicial system.
So is it unreasonable to put a gloss on other parts of the same sentence in the same statute?
I don't think so. May I just say one sentence in conclusion? I notice my red light is on. And it's to answer your question, Justice Bradley.
Then sure.
What I think this court can do is to decide whether the judge has to examine every witness, subpoena every witness, what the standards are for making those determinations. What I don't think this court can do is to permit judges to consider information other than the information, other than the petition, in making that threshold decision, because that's what you said in Riemann, and I think the legislature would have to change that. They shall examine the witnesses. If they want to make that more discretionary, they can change it to may. They sought to do in that one bill that was just introduced. Those are legislative decisions. But the issues that I've described in my brief, which you have, those are decisions which this court can do to assist not only John Doe complainants and district attorneys, but circuit judges across the state in knowing what their responsibilities are and how to conduct these John Does appropriately so we don't end up in front of you again time after time because of mistakes that are made. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Owens.
I want to pick up where Justice Crooks, I think, is right on. And I know a number of you have been prosecutors and circuit court judges. Let's review the clear and unambiguous language of Chapter 978, which defines the duties of district attorneys. 978.05, very simply put, the district attorney shall, sub 3, participate in investigatory proceedings under 968.26. So the district attorney shall participate. That would imply to me be allowed to ask your questions, examine, and I believe it indicates to me, to pick up with Justice Crook's point, a collaborative process between the duty of the district attorney I just identified and the duty of the judge as magistrate, because they are really trying to make a decision collaboratively whether a crime has been committed and should be charged. Once they get to that point, I think we're also correct, it has to move in terms of moving the prosecution forward, calling witnesses, conducting a preliminary hearing. That's going to be done by the district attorney or, in the event of a special prosecutor, by that special prosecutor. If the district attorney has not participated as the elected district attorney or his office under 978.05 sub 3, then the immediately preceding section, 978.045, talks about special prosecutors, and that special prosecutor is exercising the powers of the district attorney, probably would stay with the case. I think that continuum is intended, and it makes sense to me that it is a collaborative process, which underscores something that I think needs to be addressed for the bench in the state, and that is, if there's a problem with a conflict of interest by the district attorney, the subject is his daughter-in-law on the inquiry, that we must have a special prosecutor if we have a John Doe. If we've gotten to the threshold, we're going to have a special prosecutor. And as pointed out in my briefs, the reply brief in particular, 978.045 tells us that any judge of a court of record may appoint, and it's a may, not a shall, a special prosecutor if, sub H, this is the problem, the district attorney determines that a conflict of interest exists regarding the district attorney or district attorney staff. Well, the one problem with that language is that it's apparently giving it to the district attorney to determine whether there's a conflict, and then, therefore, whether that person would serve in the John Doe proceeding, in this instance, of himself. That problem has to be addressed, and I think if one looks at 978.045, and I think the court does need to look at that, because there will be more than one instance where the district attorney has a conflict of interest. Could be a former law partner, could be a family member, a member of his staff or their family. There are too many times in this complicated world that we're in that there will be potential conflicts of interest. And if there's a John Doe, if it's made the threshold point, I think we definitely have to get a special prosecutor. And that was a link that's been missing in the judicial bench book. It's missing in the Wisconsin jury instructions for the judges. And it's an opportunity which doesn't do any harm to the statute at all and probably would be appreciated by any judge sitting in that magistrate role, as you may imagine, to have a district attorney or a special prosecutor collaborating in this decision-making. I'm sure Judge Madden would have appreciated that, actually. But I'm guessing. The question of where it goes after the decision has been made, let's say, or not, to prosecute, one of the most famous ones we ever had in our state of a John Doe and a resulting was the Lorenzo Bembene case, and that was brought by Mr. Robbins and Chesley Irwin, the medical examiner of Milwaukee County. They felt that there were incorrect things done in the evidence that was used to convict Vince Bembene. A John Doe was held for many days and extended over weeks. And ultimately, I think 20 or 30 witnesses were called, and they did determine that while there was no crime, I believe the special prosecutor in the case, Judge Kurtz, was Mr. Kirsten, Attorney Kirsten. He can't be heard. And Judge Hayes was the presiding judge or the magistrate judge in that case. And ultimately, the determination was that there had been great improprieties done, but they didn't rise to the level of a criminal violation by anyone in the Milwaukee Police Department. But the ultimate result was, when Ms. Bembene came back from Canada, she did have a negotiated plea agreement, and her 20-year sentence was taken down to time served, and an agreement was made with the district attorney, who continued on the case after the John Doe and participated in the case, Ms. McCann.
So your red light is on.
Okay. That allowed the continuation.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for their arguments in this case. I want to note that for the students who are here, that Justice Rogensack will be available to meet and discuss with you what she intends. Justice Rogensack, are you going to start right now?
Yeah, I'll be right down. There may be another group that's coming in, and so as soon as they're seated, sort that out.
Thank you. We are in recess.